The global war on terrorism and homeland security are intertwined. Homeland security begins abroad.
Here in Baghdad, people constantly say to us as Americans, what is the matter with Mr. Bush? Why is Mr. Bush doing this?
There's genuine uneasiness about this war in a number of circles, both in elite circles as well as general public opinion.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to everybody who is out there serving our country and the military, and we hope that they get back home safely.
This is Pacifica Radio's Peace Watch for Monday, March 24th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. and British planes targeted the Iraqi Republican Guard forces just south of Baghdad today in perhaps the largest assault to date on Saddam Hussein's highly trained troops. That's according to U.S. officials. Meanwhile, the Army's 3rd Infantry Division advanced north today toward the Shiite holy city of Karbala, only 50 miles south of Baghdad, but was stalled by a sandstorm that blew out of the desert. While Iraqi paramilitary units attacked coalition troops from the rear, U.S.-led forces tried to maintain their advance on Baghdad. The troops made a rapid advance under heavy U.S. and British air protection that hit a column of charging Iraqi armor and reportedly sent some of Saddam Hussein's outer defenses withdrawing toward the capital. Earlier today, Democracy Now! Spoke with Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness on the ground in Baghdad.
We're all a little sleep-deprived because the bombing continues through the night, but each day when we wake up and realize that everyone we know, including families, has been okay, we feel relieved. But we've had a chance now to visit patients who have seen really terrible wounds in each of two hospitals. And it's clear to us that the civilian casualties are rising, and that there's absolutely no crime that any of these people have committed who are being punished so badly.
Can you talk about what you've seen in the hospital?
We've seen today 8 children who sustained multiple fracture wounds, and in one case, a child will be paralyzed for life. Met several elderly people who likewise are being treated for multiple fractures and surgeries. As quickly as possible, the doctors try to clear the patients out of the hospitals so that they can make room for more, because they're expecting many more casualties to come into the two major trauma centers that we visited. And doctors are up around the clock trying to make sure that they can cope with the emergencies as they come in.
Can you describe what the feeling is in Baghdad right now? They are talking about the siege of Baghdad in the next few days, as well as the bombing that has been taking place right now. How are you and others protecting yourselves?
Well, the feeling here is certainly one of bewilderment and high anger at why President Bush and the United States would choose to do this to people here. One man in the hospital said, "We feel ourselves like brothers and sisters to the United States. We don't try to attack their people," and pleading with us to please get this message back to the people in our country that this is an invasion and that it has nothing to do with democracy. In terms of trying to protect oneself, to be honest, I can't think of any place where one could go and feel safe right now. It's just simply no pattern to the bombing will indicate that any particular place is safe. We know of civilian neighborhoods, Aramia, Amaria, Saddam City, around commercial district here where the Al-Fanar Hotel is, that have all sustained major bombardments in places close to where civilians live. I know of one family of a hotel worker here whose home was very nearly hit. All the windows shattered and fell to the floor. The ceiling fan fell onto the floor. The children were crouched down with their hands over their heads. People are certainly trying to weather this as best they can and maintain calm so that they won't frighten the children, but I can't imagine that anybody isn't feeling both very frightened, sleep-deprived, and utterly anxious about what may be coming.
Kathy, when you leave the hotel and walk out onto the street, what is the scene outside during the day?
Well, one of the things you notice is that the sky is blackened with huge clouds of smoke because of oil fires that have been set in trenches all around the city and even in some neighborhoods. And this is apparently done for the sake of defense. You also don't have to go far before you see buildings that are completely wrecked. There's broken glass collected in intersections in various spots. There still isn't a very high military presence. In fact, Jeremy, you would remember the day there was sort of a dress rehearsal for martial law. There was far more military presence on that day before the war began than what we're seeing presently. The first question everybody asks when they see anybody is, how is your family? People who have family in Basra are very petrified. One hotel worker, very anxious for his family, left yesterday to try to find out if he could see how his family is. And we hear reports that people have gone for over 48 hours or perhaps more without any water, and it's unimaginable what kinds of conditions could result from that. That certainly is a humanitarian catastrophe. But here in Baghdad, as people anticipate, they also might undergo a state of siege. That certainly is an unsettling, very frightening feeling. And people constantly say to us as Americans, what is the matter with Mr. Bush? Why is Mr. Bush doing this?
Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness speaking from Baghdad to Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill of Democracy Now! 10 U.S. troops suffering battle-related injuries from the war in Iraq were in stable condition today, including two in intensive care, according to doctors at a U.S. military hospital in Germany. According to Captain Norris Jones, a spokesman for the U.S. European Command, six Marines and two Army soldiers were flown to Germany from Kuwait early Monday. Five U.S. captives appeared terrified as they were seen over the weekend on Iraqi television. The footage also showed at least four bodies. U.S. officials confirmed that 12 soldiers were missing after Iraqi forces ambushed an army supply convoy around An Nashriya, a major crossing point over the Euphrates northwest of Basra. The family members of one of the first U.S. casualties of the war are trying to deal with the grief of losing a loved one. Kendall Waters Bay was one of the four U.S. Marines killed in a helicopter crash in Kuwait Thursday. His grief-stricken father, Michael Waters Bay, devastated by the loss of his firstborn and his only son, had a message for President Bush. Quote, "This was not your son or daughter," said the Marine's father. "That chair he sat in at Thanksgiving will be empty forever," unquote. Tawanda Protiet, the former wife of Staff Sergeant Specialist, is the mother of his 10-year-old son, Kenneth. She spoke with Peace Watch earlier today about the path that led him into the military.
The first reaction was just that it was like, okay, what I'm going to do now, how I'm going to tell my son that his father is, you know, gone. And I mean, I was upset, and I'm still upset. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going to take a while. And not just because he's, I mean, you know, not just for me, basically for my son, because he don't have a father anymore. I never talked about joining the service, but he went in the service because I came pregnant, and he wanted to better his life and do right by his child, you know, and his family and stuff.
Mm-hmm. How is your son reacting? He's in the fifth grade. He's 10 years old.
He's doing okay. It's like he cried on and off, but he basically tried to keep his mind occupied by doing other things, you know, and, you know, being around his friends and his family and stuff. But truthfully, that I really think is going to hit him is once we really lay his father down to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a chance to speak with Kendall about this particular war, going to Iraq, when he learned that he may be going to the region?
Last time I had talked to Kendall was when he had called, told me about he was sending my son back home because he had ordered to go over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to go, but that was something he had to do because he was ordered to go.
Well, was there anything else that was on your heart or on your mind that you wanted to share with us?
Only thing that I can say that's really on my heart, that I am going to really miss him, because when I had downs and stuff, and he was the only one that I really can talk to about certain issues. And he, you know, and like I said, we might wasn't married anymore, but we always remain as best friends.
Tawanda Potiat, the former wife of Staff Sergeant Kendall Waters Bay. The Bush administration yesterday endorsed a humanitarian role in Iraq for the UN Security Council, but it balked at suggestions the council should play a political role when the fighting ends. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the United States was ready to give UN Secretary General Kofi Annan authority to run the program throughout Iraq on an interim basis and to use funds in the UN Oil for Food escrow account to pay for food, medicine, and other costs. But critics of the United States, of the UN, question whether the UN continues to be relevant in this equation. We spoke with John Cavanna, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Coerced, for his perspective on that.
Well, I would actually say that I think the UN has never been more relevant than at the current moment. And I think there are two key moments here in this history which stand out. The first is that was that George Bush actually felt sufficient pressure from the American public and from the peace movement that he felt he had to bring the war to the UN in the first place last fall in order to give it more legitimacy. I think that's a huge win for the peace movement and for the American public, and I think it shows how isolated Bush was then with what is still an extremist war and an illegal war and a radical departure from hundreds of years of how we've thought about war. So that's the first moment. And then the second is that now for at least a decade, the United States has been able to bully and buy its way through the United Nations. Whenever there was a tough vote, and this goes all the way back to the first Gulf War, the U.S. would offer aid or trade agreements or military alliances, and they would bully countries into compliance to the point where I think everyone simply assumed that the Bush administration could do that again, led by the Bush administration. I think they never thought they would have trouble. And what you saw over the past month with countries, small countries, that are dependent on the United States, standing up and saying no, standing up and siding with their publics that were overwhelmingly against war, standing up when the United States, in the case of Mexico and Chile, holds trade agreements over the heads of those countries, and in the case of the African three, Angola and Guinea and Cameroon, where the U.S. gives all of them aid and could and clearly had offered a lot more, it was amazing to see those countries stand up. And I think what you saw was that there was a wonderful piece in the New York Times on February 16th, right after the giant global protests, where Patrick Tyler, who's a journalist there, said there are now two superpowers in the world, the United States and global public opinion. And I think what happened soon after that is the United Nations, in a sense, became part of that second superpower and said, we are not going to give legitimacy to this war.
But at the end of the day, John, as amazing as it was, at the end of the day, the bombs are raining over Baghdad.
The bombs are raining over Baghdad, but I would say the United States has never been more isolated in the world. And the United States is going to wake up from this war realizing that it needs allies in Europe and in Asia and in Africa and in Latin America to do a lot of the things it wants to do, and it's going to have to do a great deal of repatching of relationships to retain its superpower status in the world and to retain the kinds of relationships one needs to operate in the world today. So I think that what the U.S. has done by going against the United Nations and in essence saying you're irrelevant and we're going to war anyway is to so isolate itself that it's going to have to come back to the United Nations and back to these nations as it begins to pick up the pieces from war.
But
it doesn't feel that way right now in the midst of war, but I think in the aftermath of war, that will be the reality.
Well, we've already heard that the reports that the U.S. says it sees the UN in a humanitarian role. But before we get to that, many people, critics, have said that Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the UN, basically caved in to the demands of the U.S. when he ordered the weapons inspectors to leave Baghdad when the Security Council had not voted to have that happen.
Well, see, I was disappointed when he did that. I was disappointed that he didn't put up more of a fight.
Could that not have averted the war had he not let the weapons
inspectors? No, I mean, the point about the United Nations is that still at this point, the United Nations is nothing more than the nations that make it up. The U.S. is the largest nation and the most powerful and gives the most money to the U.N. And I think at the moment when the U.S. said, we are going to war, it would have been, I mean, I think it would have been good for Kofi Annan to have put up at least a rhetorical fight. But since once it became clear that the U.S. was going to war, it would have looked foolhardy, I think, for Kofi Annan to have kept the inspectors there.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, and I don't think that he could have, you can't keep United Nations forces in a country when another country is about to launch the most shocking and devastating war that the world's ever seen. I think Kofi Annan made himself very clear the day before that. He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal. He said if the United States goes to war without a UN resolution, it will be an illegal war. It will be against the UN Charter. He came out strongly against what the U.S. was trying to do with his strong moral voice.
But did he actually have, the other question is, did he have the authority to order those weapons inspectors out without some sort of formal command from the Security Council?
Well, that's an interesting question, and that, you know, legal scholars can look into that. I do think that as Secretary General, he is responsible for the safety of the people who work for him. And the United States was very clear in its ultimatum that it felt it had the authority to go to war within 48 hours. And you don't want to, at a time when some legal scholars, you know, it's a minority, but argued that the U.S. had authority back in the resolution that was passed unanimously in the fall to go to war, you don't want to put your people at risk. I can understand the argument for not putting your people at risk. I think it would have been good for him to try, but I think in the end, even the French and the Germans and the Russians and the Chinese, the big opponents of the U.S. war in the U.N., would have said, get these people out of there, save their lives, since the United States is going to war anyway, and let's fight this in other formats and in other arenas. I think the huge battle now, once this war is over, is for global public opinion and U.S. public opinion to so put the Bush administration in a corner that these kinds of wars, preemptive or so-called preventative wars, are wrong, illegal, make us all less secure, that we have to make sure that the Bush administration is never able to do something like this again.
John Cavanaugh is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and co-author of Coalition of the Willing or Coalition of the Coerced. Despite protests of several hundred thousand people in the streets of New York City this weekend and recent demonstrations of tens of thousands across the country, polls show that a majority of Americans still support the war. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with John Zogby of Zogby International Polling to help us interpret some of these statistics.
Right now, about 7 out of 10 support the war, and that's not surprising. War begins and troops are engaged, Americans will rally around the troops and around the commander-in-chief, at least for a while.
But what is the question that they're being asked specifically?
Do you strongly support, somewhat oppose, or strongly oppose the war in Iraq?
And
that's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's followed up with, what if there are casualties, hundreds of American casualties? This time around, what we're finding is that support drops about 7 points if there's hundreds of American casualties. That's more out of a sense, though, of not wanting to abandon troops. But I'll tell you, my experience with this sort of stuff is that Americans like their wars to be won and they like them to be over quickly. And if there's any sense whatsoever that things are bogging down, or, as we found at least in our pre-war surveys, that there are activities involved in this war that Americans are not comfortable with.
Such as?
Meaning Iraqi civilian casualties. Support for the war will go down.
Do you find that those being polled make a distinction between supporting the troops and being in favor of the war?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. I think that they do without question. I know, for example, that in the poll that I'm presently doing, and that, you know, I have some partial results for, so I don't dare release any numbers, but I have enough evidence to suggest that, on one hand, there is not an overconfidence about, quote, winning the war. There is some uneasiness about winning the war and uneasiness about both the American casualties and the bombing of Iraq, of Baghdad already.
Have you found through your polling that there is a lot of misinformation around the facts that led us into this war? Or exactly what have you learned with regard to that?
In an instance like this, I think Americans are asking questions. Was this the time to go to war? Will our actions make things better or worse? I think that they're still asking those questions. However, I think one can make a case, whether you agree with the war or not, that when you see young men and young women, or dare I say boys and girls, over in Iraq, and see the faces of the Iraqi soldiers, who are boys as well, that there is an uneasiness about this, and that Americans want the war to be over, but they don't want Baghdad to be leveled. They don't want lots of civilian casualties. They're sensitive to the fact that it's kids, basically, who are fighting this war. I think there's a lot of sophistication among the people as a whole.
We've heard reports over the past several days of increasing military casualties as well as hostages. What effect do you think this will have on U.S. support for the war?
Preliminary findings suggest that Americans continue to rally around the troops and around the president. The thing is, how long will that continue? In the same preliminary results, I'm also finding a growing uneasiness about the war. Now, one day does not make a war. 2 days don't necessarily make a war. We're going to have to track this along the way. Preliminary results are Americans still support the president and the troops, but let's wait and see.
Some people I've spoken to on the left have criticized some of the poll results we've been hearing about recently. They say, quote, everyone I know is opposed to the war, and,
sure,
and no one I know has been called to ask their opinion. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, seriously, people on the left hang with people on the left. I get emails from the right, and they say to me, how could there be so many people opposing the war? Everybody I have coffee with, you know, at the diner, supports the president 100%. So I get name-calling from both sides. Fact of the matter is, this is why you do a national sample. It's a big country out there, and the whole country is not on the left, nor is the whole country on the right. And there's a lot of gray area in between.
We saw several hundred thousand anti-war or pro-peace protesters gathering in the streets of New York City over the weekend, and similar protests have taken place across the country and around the world over the past several weeks. Do you notice in your research growing opposition to the war?
Not at this moment. This is all very predictable, and we need to understand this. I came out with a poll last Monday, and it showed that support for the war had gone down to 54%, opposition to 42%. And when I talked to reporters, I said, but once we start this war, the president will get a spike to about 65 or 70%. That's exactly what's happened. The president has gotten that spike. Americans will rally in the beginning days and possibly even weeks of a war, for all the reasons that I've mentioned. But if for any reason this war drags on, or the casualties appear to be too high, or there is action in some way on the part of the coalition that is contrary to the values of the citizens of the countries of the coalition, you watch that support go right back down again.
John Zogby of Zogby International Polling. Well, 5 days after the start of the military conflict in Iraq, the expected exodus of refugees to Jordanian's border town of Rawashed has not yet materialized as had been predicted by the United Nations. To date, around 600 people have crossed the Jordanian-Iraqi border, many of various African nationalities, but none are Iraqi. Ula Farawadi has this report from the Jordan-Iraq border.
Dozens of Sudanese who fled the U.S.-led war on Iraq are preparing to go home after spending the night in one of the refugee camps set up by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. They tell stories of displacement and bitterly cold desert winds. Sudanese student Leila seems uncertain about her educational future. She had to leave Iraq after spending 3 years in an Iraqi university to become a veterinarian. She said university officials refused to give her any papers proving her educational achievements.
I don't know what the future holds for me. I studied 3 years in Iraq for free and I was doing very well. I don't know if I will study in a Sudanese university or go on to an Arab country and start from scratch.
No Iraqis have reached the border with Jordan yet. Officials are attributing that to the fact that many have opted to stay home despite the bombardments, while those who chose to leave cannot afford the very expensive cost of transportation on the 375 miles highway between Baghdad and the border. Anista Arbeh works with the international relief agency, CARE.
We're establishing now the tents in this camp in order to receive the Iraqi refugees. Actually, until now, we're thinking about 10,000 people could be accommodated in this camp. And there is a space for expansion in case that we have more refugees. Until now, we did not receive any refugee in this camp. Actually, the refugees will be provided with food items, and also they'll be provided with non-food items as stoves and kerosene, blankets, and cooking stuff.
The Sudanese are not enthusiastic about getting home. Some wanted to wait in Jordan to get back to their jobs in Iraq once war is over. Others feared returning to Sudan, which has been wrought with conflict for 2 decades. Rahmatullah is a father of 5. He worked in Iraq for 13 years.
Iraq is in a state of war, and we did not feel safe staying here. God willing, I am going back to Sudan. Yesterday, when the first attack happened, we were far away. We heard the sirens. It took us 7 to 8 hours to reach the border, and we were afraid all the way that a missile would strike us. I am very afraid, but we wanted to save our lives. We did not expect this war. I am both happy and sad. I'm happy I will get to see my family, but I am sad I'm leaving a country where I worked for 13 years with nothing. I only have the clothes on me now because I was in a rush to save the lives of my wife and children.
Muhammad Mutlak works with the Red Crescent. He echoed the sadness of the displaced Sudanese.
The refugees are in a very good physical condition, but psychologically they feel very bad. They don't know what happened, what to do or where to go, and many of them do not want to go back to Sudan.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati near the Iraqi-Jordanian border.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.